off to the next interlude in the Walton Violin Concerto, but we've gotten a couple of really great opportunities to hear not only the opening, but some of the development of the Walton Violin Concerto as played by my guest, Kurt Nikkanen. Good morning, Kurt, and welcome.
Good morning.
And you say this was with the New Haven Symphony and William Boughton for Nimbus, and we have a lot of William Boughton on Nimbus. Tell me about the recording project that this was for.
His idea was to do a complete overview of Walton's orchestral work, including the violin concerto. So also on that disc is the First Symphony. And so we collaborated on that in some live performances and then made the record, I guess, going on 3 years ago.
Okay. And so let's kind of pull back the lens and talk about your whole range as a violinist, because you are somebody who has a real broad sense of what you do. You
don't broad resist the spectrum. No, I've never liked to do one thing. I've always been, even as a child, I was very interested in contemporary music. And at one time I was actually considering being a composer. Yeah. I was writing a lot of stuff when I was pretty young. But I dropped that idea and decided just to stick to the interpretive end of things. But as such, I try to keep my work as varied as possible. Okay. Play a lot of chamber music. My wife, Maria Steriado, is a concert pianist. We do a lot of duo work together. We have a festival together, Concertmaster of New York City Ballet Orchestra.
The name of the festival.
You name it, I've done it.
Good. Well, and what's the name of your festival?
It's at the university where Maria teaches, which is kind of similar to what you have here. It's Kutztown, University of Pennsylvania, in between Allentown and Reading. And they have a phenomenal facility. And we realized that nobody was using it during the summer months, so we decided to make sort of a half-teaching, half-performing festival.
Nice. Yeah. Well, let's go through all of these things. Kurt Nikkanen, my guest, who's playing Beethoven tonight with the Gonzaga Symphony. But first, let's talk about your day job, because that's probably just about right, isn't it? A ballet orchestra, New York City Ballet Orchestra, is probably not too much work, not too little?
Well, it's perfect for somebody who likes to do what I do, because it's half a season. Mm-hmm. It's about 25 weeks. And although they're intense weeks, I mean, I think we play more repertoire in a season than just about any other ensemble. And it's very appealing repertoire from my point of view, because you get all the great Stravinsky ballets, you get so much juicy stuff for violin to do.
And you're the
including
concert
the,
master.
Yes, so as such, I play the Stravinsky Violin Concerto quite a bit. It's always been one of my
as
favorite
a ballet.
Pieces. As a ballet. Mm. And we'll talk about that in a minute, because what I learned through this job is, they do actually do four or five mainstream violin concertos as ballets. And you come in with this preconception of how they go. And then you combine them with the choreography, and you realize that, wait a minute, there have to be some compromises to make it work. And in the beginning, when I came to that job, the tempi were all very different than anything I'd experienced, and slowly there's been kind of a movement together, that slow shift, that they've gone more in the direction of concert tempi, and I've gotten more flexible in my approach, or there's been sort of a meeting in the middle. And it's just very exciting because, like with the Stravinsky, for example, that piece was conceived for ballet at a moment in the company's history that was so important, when Balanchine and Stravinsky collaborated on all of those great ballets, Agon or Apollo or the Violin Concerto. There was such a seamless interaction between the two of them. And so now I really feel that the music and dance in that piece are inseparable. If I play it in concert now, I can't really imagine it without the stage action. And it's what we're doing is pretty much close to Stravinsky's own tempo markings.
So it's a wonderful opportunity to learn from another approach, as you say.
Yeah, that's right. Just as if you do Bach with mm-hmm. dance, it's an education in itself, because if you imagine steps with the dance movements of the partitas, you feel the weight of the rhythmic gesture in a way that you don't if it's more abstract. You feel a sort of more visceral, physical side to the music that maybe you didn't before.
And I'm speaking with Kurt Nickinen, who's playing Beethoven tonight with Gonzaga. But continuing to talk about your life and the range of things that you get to do. So if we call that your day job, your thing that you can depend on, then what do you fit in around that as the important things for you to do?
A bit of teaching.
Regularly at a school?
Private teaching at this point. Mm-hmm. Although I've gone to schools to give master classes and things like that, but teaching is something I particularly love. More and more as I go on, I'm drawn to it. So who knows? I mean, maybe one day I'll have a formal relationship with the school. But
so when you teach, are you passing on? It's kind of a dumb question. Passing on everything you've gotten, or have you found some new ways to kind of amalgamate some things and think of something new?
You know, you're always responding to the individual student. They're bringing something when they come in for the lesson, and you have to figure out what it is they need from you. And every student needs something different. So it's tempting to want to impose the way you've learned to do things or the way experience has taught you to do things on that student. But it doesn't always work. Sometimes you have to try to put yourself more in the student's place and learn a little bit about what is... sometimes it's as basic as learning what motivates them to make music and what they want to do. Everybody's coming in from a different background and wanting... I mean, not everybody wants to be a big soloist. Not everybody's dreaming about the same things musically, and not everybody has the same taste that you have. So I'm part of the lesson, I'm trying to just open their ears a bit. And sometimes the less I say, the better. Sure. I know that sounds a little bit zen, but in the beginning when I started teaching, I threw a great deal of information at them, and I started wondering how much of that are they actually going to remember. So I try to distill it now down to two or three basic things just for them to think about and apply to the next time. Mm-hmm. And actually that seems to work better.
Nice. And so that's the teaching part. You earlier mentioned that once upon a time you wanted to be a composer. So talk about what interaction you get to have in your life currently with new music.
Quite a bit, actually. I have played a number of new concerti, some with the ballet, some outside of the ballet. I mean, my first experience, I guess, playing a work by a major new composer was the Adams Concerto, which I had the good fortune to learn at a time when it was getting played a lot. So I must have played that 20 or 30 times. And that was an interesting experience because I'd never played a new work that many times until it started to feel like a standard piece. And, you know, so very often we learn a brand new piece and we play it once and shelve it and or maybe record it and that's it. So that was very interesting. Along the way I've played the Thomas Addis Violin Concerto. Great piece. Looking forward to learning Chris Theofanidis' Violin Concerto pretty soon. My wife and I are playing a recital on November 6th and we're doing actually the composer's own transcription of the slow movement of that concerto for violin and piano. It's a beautiful piece. So it's great joy to collaborate with the composer.
Famous semi-apocryphal stories about the Barber Concerto in the last movement. In what ways are these, and writing something hard that somebody resisted, in what ways are these composers affecting violin and violin technique?
Well, some of them are stretching the boundaries more than others. I mean, Addis in particular, I would say, pushed the upper limit of violin technique. So much of the, especially the outer movements of his concerto, are up in the rosin, as they say, where your fingers are so high. I mean, I think he goes to the last note on the piano keyboard quite a bit.
Wow.
And not just in an effect driven kind of way, but he's writing melodies up there that are meant to be sung out. And it's extremely challenging, as you can imagine, but his sound world is unlike any other. And I think many of the composers are going not so much in the direction of effects anymore. They did for a while, but now it's more just stretching the expressive capabilities of what a violin can do and the dynamic capabilities and creating something new.
And the violin, with all of that great 400 years of history and that great tradition, does the violin continue to be able to say new things in new music to new audiences?
I think it does. And the music that's being written now is, I think without being self-consciously more accessible, is going in the direction of greater accessibility. The Gerber that I gave you, that CD, if you have a listen to that, it's firmly grounded in sort of great music of the past. There's in my view, a very close resemblance to Brahms. His writing, for example, structurally, and it's shamelessly tonal, as I like to say. He's a composer who interests me because he started out writing strict 12-tone music and went in a completely tonal direction and with fantastic results. He's written a couple of symphonies and, you know, many orchestral works that are sort of an outgrowth of the past traditions. And it's interesting to see to what degree music can exist now without leaving the past behind.
We're here. We have the recording. Why don't we take a few minutes?
And yeah, take a few minutes. Exactly. Just hear a snippet
what
of that.
You've been talking about. Shall we begin at the beginning?
Why not?
Okay, this is the first movement of Violin Concerto, recorded by my guest, Kurt Nickinen, by Stephen Gerber. the first movement of a violin concerto by composer Stephen Gerber, played by my guest Kurt Nikkanen. He was joined by the National Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Pyotr Gajewski, who's a conductor who will be coming here for the Bach Festival, as will Kurt Nikkanen, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. First, just a bit more about that gorgeous piece that we just heard in the conductor. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I first met Stephen, the composer, when I was fresh out of Juilliard, and he was looking for somebody to do a violin and piano piece that he'd written that was very interesting to me in that it combined elements of Bartok and his theme and variations kind of works with a minimalist approach, just concentrating on seconds, ninths, and sevenths, and somehow limiting himself to those means, he created something that was so expressive, and it was unlike anything else. Then a number of years later, he decided to write a violin concerto for me. I was very honored. And so we arranged some performances first. I think we played it in Siberia, in Novosibirsk in the winter or something. I remember it being very, very cold. And then later, I met Peter Gajewski, and we did it with his orchestra. I think we played it in Maryland, and then we recorded it the following year. Don't know how old that recording is, but it goes back more than 10 years at this point.
It says 2000 on it.
Yeah, that sounds right. But again, to me, I'm interested in playing any music from any period if it strikes me as being just so beautiful and unapologetically beautiful and not in a hard-on-the-sleeve romantic kind of way, but in a way that reminds you of the great classicists of the past. And Stephen's music had that character. And it's almost, I think, unpopular for composers to just write beautifully nowadays. It's so rare that you find that. So anyway, I loved the whole experience of playing his piece, and I love his music in general. I also did a CD of his chamber works, which I didn't bring with me today, sure, but I will another time.
Good. Well, and probably you could just change the names and say much of the stuff that you said about him, about Beethoven also.
Well, yeah, of course. There's a reason those pieces are timeless, and I keep coming back to them. I mean, especially the Beethoven. That piece, to me, is so moving precisely because it does that. It's the thematic material is very simple, and he gets maximum meaning out of very, very simple means and develops them so beautifully. For me, that's the greatest achievement in any symphonic work, and that concerto in particular, I think, kind of straddles the boundary between what is concerto and what is symphonic. As a soloist, you're the soloist, but you're an integral part of the big canvas. And I think it was really the first work to do that, to pull it off successfully.
And so, kind of the usual questions about a Beethoven concerto. You probably played it all your life in different circumstances and times of your life. How much does it change? How much does it stay the same?
I like to talk about this question with one of my friends, Alan Moverman, fantastic pianist. We have this discussion every time we play a piece together that we've played a lot before. And I like to say that the main building blocks stay the same. It's just your options narrow. The more you learn about the piece, the less inclined you are to go in certain directions. So it's sort of like you winnow it down to the what for you are the choices you're most comfortable with. And it's not that you play it the same every time, but the basic framework is going to pretty much be in that vicinity. And to keep it so then the question becomes, how do you keep it fresh? If you're no longer searching for some revolutionary new way of doing it that's just different than anything you've done before. I mean, sometimes it can be about that. If I think about a piece that I haven't played for a while, and it occurs to me that I'm unhappy with the way I always played it, and I want to go in a different direction. Sometimes that happens, like going in a direction of playing Mozart more period, or you know, with less vibrato or whatever. But with the Beethoven, not so much the case. I mean, that's been relatively consistent. It's just been in the details, and so what I focus on, if I'm playing a piece a lot, and actually the ballet taught me this as well, because you have to repeat things so much. After doing 50 Stravinsky concertos, what can you possibly say about it? And for me, it's just looking, every time I do it, I try to look at the score and I find one detail that escaped me the last time I did it. It doesn't have to be many, it can be just one that gets me excited and say, okay, oh, that's the one, I want to share that tonight. And sometimes that one, changing that one detail actually changes other things as well, but it just points a direction to go in. It's always dangerous if I say, oh, I'm unhappy with that, you know, I'm going to change everything, then somehow the result isn't as good.
Yeah. And the choices you have on cadenza are what for the Beethoven?
Well, Kreisler. Mm-hmm. I still love those the best. I appreciate, and I've played some of the other cadenzas, and I've tried writing my own. But the Kreisler, for me, remains the classic, and I can see doing other cadenzas. Actually, I found some by Saint-Saëns the other day that intrigued me a little bit, but this time around, it's going to be the Kreisler.
And so what does the Kreisler cadenza say?
Well, again, it's very simple. Especially the first movement cadenza has a grandeur about it, but it's not overwritten, and the point of it is very much in keeping with the whole of the concerto. It's not showy in the sense that the hour is, or the Milstein, or, you know, and there's a place for that. And I know people love to play those and hear them, but the Kreisler for me has the dignity and the spaciousness of the work. And so for that piece, I would want a cadenza that doesn't stick out as something else, you know, but that it's somehow integrated.
My guest, Kurt Nickinen, who's playing this piece he's talking about, the Beethoven Violin Concerto with the Gonzaga Symphony. It's tonight at 7:30 in the Fox, is that concert, which also includes music of Rossini and Berlioz. And let's save most of this for when you come back, but give us about 1 minute preview of what you're going to be doing with Bach here when you come back. And
well, that's very interesting too.
Early March.
Yeah. Yes, that is
somewhere in there.
Very interesting, because not only am I doing two sonatas and a partita, but not all in the same concert. See, the way Zula structured it, it's very appealing. I mean, it's the first time I've brought all this Bach, but not done it as a Bach evening. So I'll do one of the sonatas on one evening, another on the next, another on the other, and there'll be other works as well, I guess. And I'm going to play the G minor transcription of the F minor harpsichord concerto, which I think it's Bach's own transcription, but violinists play it in G minor, with string quartet and possibly continuo accompaniment. And I've experimented with such small forces before, and it works pretty well. I've done both the A minor and the E major with a quartet and harpsichord. And you don't lose much. I mean, it's so transparent anyway. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Good.
And I think he's got some other fun stuff planned, not relating to Bach, some party pieces.
And in a few months, we'll be talking about that. My guest, Kurt Nickinen, who's here again with the Gonzaga Symphony tonight at 7:30.